Hi, I'm Marshall Palmer, and this is Policy Talks. Welcome to Policy Talks, a show focused on policy analysis in international affairs. In this episode, we'll be taking a look at Saudi Arabia's domestic and foreign policies, particularly how they've changed since Mohammed bin Salman became Crown Prince of the Kingdom in 2017. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia formed as a result of gradual unification by Ibn Saud between 1902 and 1932. Today, the state is an absolute monarchy centered upon the House of Saud. It is ruled by King Salman, with his son, Mohammed bin Salman, serving as the Crown Prince. MBS, as he is known, also serves as Defense Minister and Chairman of the Council for Economic and Development Affairs. MBS has brought in several social reforms to the traditional, religiously conservative country, like lifting the ban on female drivers and reducing the powers of the religious police. His Vision 2030 proposes more economic diversification for Saudi Arabia and further development of public sectors like health and education. Saudi Arabia is particularly prominent on the international stage due to its oil reserves. Recent estimates indicate that it currently possesses 22% of the world's oil reserves, making it second only to Venezuela and ahead of Canada. It is also the largest oil producer and exporter in the world. It wields considerable influence over Sunni Islam, as it is home to two of the religion's holiest cities, Mecca and Medina. Saudi Arabia has been a significant Western ally due to its influence on world oil prices and cooperation with Western countries, the United States in particular, in the fight against Islamic terrorism. Despite a growing number of human rights violations, Saudi Arabia and the West continue to trade and they cooperate militarily in Yemen and elsewhere in the Middle East. How have the events in the past few years and MBS's leadership affected Saudi Arabia's place on the international stage? To understand how Saudi Arabia's policies have changed, I spoke with Professor F. Gregory Gause, the head of the Department of International Affairs at the Bush School of Government and Public Service. Professor Gause's area of expertise is the international politics of the Middle East, particularly the Arabian Peninsula and the Persian Gulf, and he has written extensively on the subject for numerous publications. He was previously a research fellow at the King Faisal Center for Islamic Studies and Research in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, as well as a Fulbright scholar at the American University in Kuwait. Professor Gause, welcome to Policy Talks.
My pleasure.
I want to start by talking about the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. He appears to be holding the reins of power. It seems like he has sidelined all opposition, centered power within himself. But how stable is his rule, really? Are there any factions within the Saudi royal family that could challenge him? And how influential is the actual king, King Salman?
So, a couple of questions there. First off, the king is extremely influential. He is the most important constituency here, and he's the one that I think Mohammed bin Salman has the closest relation with, which is why I would say that Mohammed bin Salman's position in the power structure is pretty secure. It's a big family, and while MBS has successfully consolidated power in his hands because he has his father behind him, I would say that the next turning point or the next kind of critical transition will be when the king dies. Will the crown prince have enough kind of power concentrated in his hands, and will he have kind of deflected the possibilities of coalitions forming in the family against him enough that transition is smooth? That'll be the last kind of hurdle for him. There are certainly people in the family who object to his rise to power over them and his concentration of power within the family. That will really be their last chance to try to stop him. In an effort to head that off, I think that MBS has been cultivating an even younger generation in the family, people who are roughly his age, but of the fourth generation of the family. He's of the third generation, the grandson of the founding king. He's been cultivating people in the fourth generation and appointing them to positions in the provinces. And so I think he's trying to develop his own kind of basis of power and strength within the family among the younger folks.
Okay, and it appears like then the risk of there being a palace coup is quite low. Is that correct?
So I would say that coup in the sense of a military coup, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Largely because MBS has been able to consolidate control over the instruments of force in the government. He's the defense minister. He has appointed the head of the National Guard. He has appointed the head of the Ministry of the Interior. So at least on paper, it looks like he has the instruments of coercion wrapped up. Now, if we're talking about kind of a broader definition of a coup, could there be a movement in the family against him? Yes, that's more likely, I think, than a mm-hmm. than a kind of a military intervention here. But I don't see the signs that kind of strong faction, a blocking faction within the family, has emerged. Now, the Al Saud play things pretty close to the vest, and so I don't want to say that it's impossible for there to be a strong blocking element form in the family. I just haven't seen, you know, what I would consider to be public manifestations of such a bloc forming.
Great. Let's talk about his social policies. Gender relations have clearly been something he wants to at least show that he's at the forefront of, but so have changes in mass entertainment, live music, and even professional wrestling championships. But how strongly are these changes challenged, or how strongly have these changes challenged the austere religious beliefs of Wahhabist Islam? And how warmly have these reforms been received in the wider public?
So there's certainly these reforms, the social reforms, are, I think, very warmly received among large swaths of the Saudi population. And anecdotal evidence indicates that among young Saudis, there's very strong support. That doesn't mean that there won't be a backlash. I'm kind of surprised that we haven't seen more backlash, actually, because the religious establishment is an important and powerful social institution, and there are plenty of people who believe that rather austere interpretation of Islam is the right interpretation of Islam. So it's interesting that there's been so little public manifestations of any kind of pushback. I think that would be a really interesting indicator of MBS's standing. If you start to see those kinds of things more often or on a more organized basis. Like the one-off protest or even a one-off bombing of a movie theater or something, I think that's something that, frankly, we probably should expect. But if we begin to see more concentrated opposition to the opening up of social life, that would be an indication that underneath the surface there's probably movement, serious movement within the family as well, to try to restrict MBS's power.
Mm-hmm. And as much as these social policies are designed for Saudis, they also form part of MBS's charm offensive in the West.
Right.
But to what extent has the West reconciled this progressive vision with the human rights abuses and essential war crimes that are perpetrated by the Saudi government, including most recently and famously the killing of Jamal Khashoggi?
It hasn't. Saudi Arabia has never met even kind of the minimum standards from the human rights agenda as it's defined in the West, either in terms of democracy or political freedoms or social freedoms. And so it's always been a tension in U.S.-Saudi relations and relations between Western European countries and the Saudis. But the strategic imperatives of oil and Persian Gulf military balances and general the Middle East strategic situation has always outweighed the human rights elements.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned oil. The Saudi economy has been heavily reliant, obviously, on the production and export of oil for decades. Given the scale of this reliance, How feasible is it for Saudi Arabia to diversify away from oil, which of course is outlined in Vision 2030?
So I think that it's not practical in terms of achieving 100% of the goals of Vision 2030. But I think that you set those goals way out there in order to try to get 30% of the way. Saudi Arabia will always be, at least as long as oil is a global commodity, it's always going to be a major oil exporter, and that's always going to be a large part of the Saudi economy. But I think that Vision 2030, as ambitious as it is, if it gets you know, even 30% of the way, it will have changed enough of the economic structure in Saudi Arabia to put the Saudi economy on a sounder footing. But the transition there is it's not simple. It will entail major changes in the relationship between Saudi citizens and the state. We've already seen some of that with the reduction in subsidies for electricity and water, and that you know, that hits home. That raises the cost of these commodities, which had been basically provided nearly for free by the Saudi government to its citizens, raises the cost of those citizens. Saudis have tried to mitigate the burden there by establishing what's called the citizens' account, which is a cash transfer to lower-income Saudis, but the citizens' account doesn't make up for all of the price increases. It's going to be a wrenching transition for Saudis to go into the private sector. You know, they've been, most Saudis, almost all Saudis work in the government sector. And it's, you know, a lot of those jobs don't have a whole lot of responsibilities. And so the transition of kind of forcing people out of the government sector into the private sector is going to be disruptive. And it's not going to be smooth. And the short-term consequences have already been disruptive for the economy. I mean, one of the things that you want to do, Vision 2030 wants to do, is reduce the number of foreign laborers in the country. Get Saudis doing at least some of those jobs. But with the foreign laborers gone, it actually reduces the market in Saudi Arabia, and you have something of an economic slowdown, partially as a result of, you know, hundreds of thousands of foreign laborers leaving the country.
And relatedly, to what extent has foreign investor confidence been hit by arbitrary decisions by MBS, such as the Khashoggi killing and the anti-corruption measure where he imprisoned the various business elite in the Riyadh Ritz?
I think it's always a mistake to think that capital is courageous and that it's going to invest in uncertain situations. And I think that the thing about the Ritz-Carlton Roundup is that Saudi businessmen domestically and foreign investors who were interested in Saudi Arabia saw that the old rules no longer apply, but they don't know what the new rules are. And I think that has created a lot of uncertainty in the business community. I think it's led to capital flight in terms of domestic investors taking their money out of Saudi Arabia. But I think that most importantly, it's created, as you said in your question, a lot of uncertainty, and capital doesn't like uncertainty.
We'll have more with Professor Gause after a quick break. You're listening to the Policy Talks podcast, recorded at CKCU 93.1 FM and in partnership with iAffairs Canada. To listen to more episodes, go to www.policytalkspodcast.com or subscribe on iTunes and other podcast providers.
Breaking news tonight on a very dark subject, the murder of American-based Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, specifically whether the de facto Saudi ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, ordered the killing. According to new reporting, which first broke in the Washington Post, the CIA has concluded the answer is yes, which may be tough for the White House to swallow given how tightly the administration has tied its fortunes to that prince known by many as MBS.
The murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi has reignited debates of to what extent Western countries should maintain their diplomatic relationships with Saudi Arabia. It also shattered MBS's persona as a liberal reformer. I continue speaking with Professor Gauz about Saudi Arabia's role on the international stage and its relationship with the United States. Let's turn to foreign policy. Sure. Many scholars write about there being a Cold War in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia on one hand and Iran on the other. What are the main features of this Cold War, and how well is Saudi Arabia faring?
So I think that it's a useful but somewhat distorting shorthand to see the crisis in the Middle East as basically being a proxy war between Saudi and Iran. I think there's a lot of other players in the game. The Turks, for example, play into Syria in a way that I think is more important than the Saudis do. The Iranians obviously have an enormous role in Syria. The Yemen situation is a Saudi-Iranian proxy war, but it's complicated by the fact that the Emiratis also have a stake there, and that the local players in Yemen are not necessarily lining up, you know, single file behind their quote-unquote patrons. So it's a complicated situation. But if we look at it through this kind of simplifying framework of Iran versus Saudi, the Iranians are winning and the Saudis are losing. The Saudis had hoped to be able to roll back Iranian power in Syria by getting rid of Assad. That's failed. The Saudis had hoped to be able to compete with Iran in Lebanon and try to clip the wings of Hezbollah, reduce its power, and they failed. The Iranians remain the dominant regional influence in the Iraqi government, although I think the Saudis are reengaging in an interesting way there and trying to give Iraqi politicians an option to Iranian patronage. But in general, I think that you know, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Yemen, at least so far, and in Iraq, the Iranians are winning.
And of course, if the Saudis do have one apparent advantage, it's that they have a strong relationship with the United States. The U.S. has often shied away from critiquing Saudi Arabia on human rights issues. And the Americans have provided some degree of diplomatic cover for Saudi Arabia with regards to the war in Yemen. Nevertheless, it seems as if this current presidential administration is especially willing to align itself with the Saudis. And to what extent have the most risky decisions of the past few years, such as the Qatari embargo, the forced resignation of the Lebanese Prime Minister Saeed Harari, and the Khashoggi killing, to what extent have these been enabled by a belief that the U.S. will back Saudi Arabia to the hilt?
Well, we can't know that because we can't get into the decision-making process in Saudi Arabia in a way that is authoritative. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think MBS is going to tell us, oh, yeah, Trump gave me the green light on these things. But I think it's a fair supposition that the strong support of President Trump has led MBS and the people around him to think that there's not a high price to pay for adventurous foreign policy. Certainly on the Qatar issue, the president undercut then-Secretary of State Tillerson and then-Secretary of State Mattis, who did what normal American diplomacy would do in a situation between allies. They immediately rushed to try to mediate it. But the president undercut them by basically saying, you know, the Qataris had better behave themselves, and they're terrorists, and all that kind of thing, which I think just set back the process of trying to mend that rift. I think that the fundamental problem with the Trump administration towards Saudi Arabia is that they involve themselves too much in the politics of the family. The Trump administration kind of picked MBS as a favorite, pushed him. I don't think that without that, I don't think that if the Trump administration had played a more normal role towards Saudi Arabia and not gotten involved in these family politics, I'm not sure that MBS would have made the move that he did to sideline the then Crown Prince, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. The Trump administration has made Saudi Arabia a partisan issue in the same way that in many ways it's making Israel a partisan issue by getting too involved in the domestic politics of these places. We see that with the Trump administration's moves on Israel to support Prime Minister Netanyahu in his election campaign. To some extent, he did the same thing with Mohammed bin Salman in his quote-unquote election campaign to become crown prince. And I think that when you do that, you attach American interest too much to a single leader. And if that leader stumbles or falls, then American interests stumble with it.
And relatedly, many scholars have recommended similar things, that the United States should adopt a more transactional approach to Saudi Arabia. This seems like quite wise advice, but it's not followed. And so why do you think it is that American leaders, especially within the White House, regardless of party, consistently maintain such a special relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Well, I actually think it's because the relationship is transactional. Maybe during the Cold War, you could say that it was deeper than that because we had this overarching global conflict in which the Saudis and the Americans were going to be on the same side. But let's remember one of the biggest crises in U.S.-Saudi relations was during the Cold War when the Saudis initiated the oil embargo on the United States during the Arab-Israeli War of 1973. I think since the end of the Cold War, and particularly since 9/11, the relationship has gotten much more transactional. But that's why I think American presidents want to have a good relationship with Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of business to transact. I mean, it's nice to have some influence with the largest oil exporter in the world. In the post-9/11 environment, we the United States, desperately needed strong intelligence collaboration with a country like Saudi Arabia that could gain access to these networks of Salafi jihadists because they had people who were pretty close to it. And so I think that the reason that every American president, really since Roosevelt, has wanted to have good relations with Saudi is because there's plenty of business to transact.
And perhaps one of those businesses might be the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. Saudi Arabia and Israel appear now to be tacitly cooperating in a number of ways, drawn together as they are by mutual hostility towards Iran. But is there any prospect for a more formal Saudi-Israeli relationship to emerge? Could a potential peace deal, a revivified 2002 peace plan, appear on the horizon?
So I think that you're absolutely right that the Saudis and the Israelis are doing all sorts of business under the table. But to bring it above the table, it seems to me that you're going to need an Israeli government that's willing to revive a two-state solution peace process with the Palestinian Authority. We don't know what Mr. Kushner is going to propose in the quote-unquote deal of the century, but I doubt it's going to be a full-fledged two-state solution, largely because it seems to me that Israeli politics has moved considerably to the right from that period in the early 2000s when there was some hope that maybe the Israelis and the PLO would come to a two-state solution. Short of a two-state solution, it seems to me that no Saudi government in the short term is going to take the heat domestically and regionally that would come from an open relationship with Israel. And to some extent, they don't need it. The Israelis are cooperating with them on a range of important issues that serves both countries' interests in their common confrontation with Iran. And thus, the Saudis can kind of get the benefits without paying the cost because the Israelis see it as in their interest as well. So it seems to me that unless we get a real change in Israeli politics or a real change in American politics, it would push the Israelis toward something approaching a two-state solution. I doubt that the Saudis will move toward a more public relationship with Israel.
And to what extent is Palestine even a strong issue for the average Saudi citizen?
So I think it's probably stronger than we think. I mean, it was never as strong as was made out back in the Arab nationalist days of the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. and even into the 70s. But I would say that you know, there was never a more popular moment for King Faisal than when he put the oil embargo on the United States in support of the Arab side in the Arab-Israeli War of 73. And I think that there remains a strong sentiment of sympathy toward the Palestinians. Now, does that mean that people are going to go and risk their lives to the Palestinians, or does that mean they're going to risk Saudi Arabia's own interest? No. But I do think that at both the elite level and the mass level, not only just in Saudi Arabia, but throughout the Arab world, there remains a strong current of sympathy to the Palestinians. And any kind of move toward Israel that isn't accompanied by something that looks like an acceptable peace process with the Palestinians is going to be difficult for authoritarian leaders to pull off. Doesn't mean they can't pull it off, but there'd be a price to pay to do it.
Professor Gauz, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Policy Talks. Remember to visit us at policytalkspodcast.com and to follow us on Twitter at Policy Talks Pod for updates and related content. We would like to acknowledge the support of partners at iAffairs Canada, an online media hub based at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University. iAffairs Canada engages the diverse international affairs community in Canada and around the world to produce policy research, recommendations, and commentary on foreign policy issues, with a specific focus on students, emerging scholars, and young professionals. You can visit them at iAffairsCanada.com to learn more. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge the hard work of our producer, Joe Venkatesh, and my fellow researcher, Mark Hyken, in putting together this episode. Until next time, I'm Marshall, and this is Policy Talks.